We'll now then, brethren and sisters, continue our studies on the dwelling place of Yahweh and turn our attention now to Brother Philip as he addresses us on that subject, Solomon's Temple. Brother Philip, please.
For thus saith Yahweh that created the heavens, Elohim himself that formed the earth, and made it. He hath established it, he created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am Yahweh, and there is none else.
Like many parts of the scriptures, that verse which I have read from Isaiah 45 and verse 18 provides one of the key to the plan and purpose that the deity had and has in forming the earth. And I'd like, if I may, in the development of my address this morning, or this afternoon, to trace the lessons we have learnt already from the address which we listened to yesterday evening by Brother Robert, and that which we have just heard from Brother Stephen, as we follow this particular theme of the deity desiring to dwell with man. Because when we consider it, we find great difficulty in even beginning to get to grips with that sublime thought that the one who hath created the stupendous universe which man cannot measure, the creator of such an extensive area, desires to dwell with weak, frail, puny man. And verses such as we have contemplated in Isaiah help us to get to grips with the fact that we are dealing with not an abstract power, but one who is characterized by love and mercy and the fraternal exercise of communion. He desired in the creation of the earth to dwell with man. He created it to be inhabited by a people who would, as Brother Robert brought out last night, voluntarily give him the praise which is his due. That plan was initially frustrated, and I'd like now if we could go back to the book of Genesis, because of the entrance into the world of sin. And Brother Robert laid the foundation for us last night in the contemplation of these thoughts. And Brother Robert, you will remember, said to us that the deity could have wiped out creation and started all over again. That was not, however, the plan that he devised. And the plan that he devised, recorded for us in the details of Genesis 3, remind us once again that he desires to extend his love and his mercy and to invite men and women into the fraternal unity that they once enjoyed in Eden, but now upon very acute principles and conditions which he lay down in the changed order of things in the beginning. As Brother Robert indicated to us, Adam and Eve had a unique position and fellowship with the deity, which was interrupted by the entrance of sin and the disobedience of Adam and Eve in partaking of the forbidden fruit. But even though the circumstances now had altered, Yahweh in his love still indicated that he wanted to dwell with man. And I think it's highly significant that the very expulsion of Adam and Eve from the garden, that the principles of salvation coupled with this great purpose to dwell with man is established. At the very point of Adam and Eve's expulsion from the garden, and we read in verse Verse 23, Yahweh Elohim sent him forth from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from whence he was taken. So he drove out the man, and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubim and a flaming sword, which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life. The verse is pregnant with meaning, brethren and sisters, when we consider it. He placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubim and a flaming sword, which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life. We've got various aspects which spring to mind, brethren and sisters, when we consider those verses. We've got the fact that there was a function, there was an existence, and there was a position. The cherubim now enshrined the purpose of the deity to dwell with man. That word placed there. He drove out the man and he placed at the east of the garden is the word which Brother Steve has brought to our attention this morning. It is the word shakan. He placed at the east of the garden. He placed in existence the opportunity for men and women to worship him and to come to him upon the principles of truth, which he now had cemented in the shedding of blood that had just taken place before this expulsion of Adam and Eve. And the function of this cherubim, even a flaming sword, as Brother Thomas translates it, was it to bar man? Was it to thrust man away? Don't you dare come near this holy sanctuary, this holy shrine, lest you will be executed. We are told specifically it was to keep the way to the tree of life. It was to keep the way. The way, that's the word Derek in the Hebrew, I believe, he means a trodden path. And we could go through the scriptures and look at that path, that way, which is highlighted in various places in the scriptures. But the cherubim was not necessarily barring. Yes, there was now a distance. Adam and Eve could not enjoy the fraternity that they once did. But it wasn't a situation that would keep man completely away. I think it was the idea is probably summed up in what Brother Steve described to us in the tabernacle, when he says, let them make me a sanctuary. And Brother Steve indicated that there was this aspect of separation as well as the desire to dwell. And the reconciling of those two aspects is the very subject that we're considering. The fact that Yahweh does desire to dwell with man, even after the fall, even after sin had broken that unique relationship that Adam and Eve experienced, Yahweh still desired to dwell with man, but the cherubim spoke of the principles upon which man could do that. And Brother Steve emphasized that to us in the tabernacle. Yahweh still wanted to do it. He still wanted man to recognize it, that he wanted association with him, but upon principles that he had laid down. There were now conditions which man had to follow carefully. And this was basically seen in the two sons of Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel. We know that Abel looked at the cherubim as just a place to put offerings. And so he brought the fruit of the ground. Abel recognized the principles of salvation, which had been demonstrated in the clothing of Adam and Eve. Yahweh, yes, he placed those cherubims, that shakan, that permanent residency that Brother Steve denoted, Strong says, to lodge, to reside, to permanently stay or abide. Yahweh wanted that to happen. The question is, would man understand that principle? We feel Cain did not understand it. He didn't understand the fact that when the cherubim had been established, it wasn't just a place to put down offerings. It was a place truly to offer, as Yahweh had indicated, but it was a place where the deity was desiring to show that there was still an opportunity to commune with him, to preserve that way to the tree of life. I'd like briefly to look at the verse that Brother Steve fixed the central part of his address on. If we turn quickly to Exodus chapter 25. Exodus chapter 25, and we reread that verse 8. Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. It was in many ways an individual thing prior to the calling out of God's people from Israel. The patriarchal times almost seem to us very individually based. And it was like that even with the antediluvians. We know very little about that period, even though it was a long period of time. And we have the faithfulness of Abel shining forth, and we feel that Abel understood this great desire that God has to dwell with man. And yet for the majority, by the time we get to chapter 6 of Genesis, and we know we've traversed 1600 years of history, those principles have been lost, and the whole of civilization was swept away after the flood. The principles were held and cherished by men such as Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. But now when we come to this particular point in time, as Brother Steve has indicated to us, Yahweh has now chosen a nation, his people, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, and he's called them unto himself. And once again, on a national basis, but a nation is only made up of individuals, on a national basis, Yahweh declares that he still desires to dwell with them. And again, as Brother Steve pointed out, that word dwell, shakan, incidentally, we get the word shekinah from that word shakan. We don't tend to hear it so much nowadays, at least I don't hear it that often, but we used to hear the word shekinah glory used quite a lot in studies years ago. And yet the word Shekinah is not an authorized version word, but I think it was the word that the Jews would use to depict the glory of Yahweh that dwelt between the cherubim, the Shekinah glory, the glory of the dwelling. And here Yahweh specifically says to Israel, I want to dwell among you. Again, Brother Steve hit the nail smack on the head when the very first piece of furniture or equipment, whatever we might want to refer to, was the ark. And the principles associated with that ark were demonstrated in verse 22. He says, there will I meet with thee, and I will commune with thee from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim which are upon the ark of the testimony. And again, the principles of salvation are laid down firmly for Israel to observe and consider, to realize and understand that God again had this desire to dwell with Israel, but the conditions were there. I do desire to meet with thee. I do desire to dwell with thee. But it was upon the mercy seat, between the cherubim, where the blood on the Day of Atonement was sprinkled. And we remember those words that Brother Roberts used in not Law of Moses, not anywhere, but there, over a blood sprinkled mercy seat, Brother Roberts says, over a God vindicated slain lamb. The principles of salvation which Abel understood in God's desire to dwell with man, and the principles of the truth that were being established, Abel understood. Would Israel understand these same conditions? The question that we would consider is, how can God dwell with man? As we've said at the outset, it's almost difficult to get one's mind around the concept of the eternal Creator desiring to dwell with man. And on a practical basis, we have to consider for ourselves the question, well, yes, God does desire to dwell with man, but on a practical basis, how can that be realized? And again, what Brother Steve has indicated in the principles that the tabernacle taught Israel, it was on the lessons of obedience and on assimilating the principles of truth which God was laying down. Abel understood it, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob would have understood it, and the faithful at the time when the tabernacle was established would be understanding that principle. If God is going to dwell with man, surely it's not just between the cherubims in itself. Surely it's not just by the cherubim which preserved the way to the tree of life. Surely that's not God's intention, just to be at some focal point where men would and women would bring sacrifices mechanically. The principles which God was establishing were showing and teaching that God's desire was a reciprocal thing. If man wanted God to dwell as God wanted to dwell with man, then man had to conform and to enter into the principles of the truth that God was establishing. Time moved on from the tabernacle, and those lessons that we're trying to lay down in these principles that had been established, they were forgotten. Not by the remnant. As we move through the pages of Old Testament history, we would recognize that there would always be a remnant. But to a large extent, the principles were forgotten. Let's illustrate it. 1 Samuel chapter 4. If ever there was a time when this principle of God desiring to dwell with man upon certain conditions was forgotten, it was during this period of the Judges, when every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And you'll remember the circumstances that 1 Samuel 4 indicates, when the just at the end period of the time of the Judges, when the Philistines were coming and the people wanted to battle against the Philistines. And it says in verse 3, when the people were coming to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Wherefore hath Yahweh smitten us today before the Philistines? Let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies." And yes, I did emphasize it there. Whatever convoluted process of thought that the children of Israel had at this time, which might have gone back to the time when Joshua and the people carried forth the ark upon their shoulders and went through the Jordan and on into the promised land, whatever they might have thought upon that, they missed the whole point of the desire of Yahweh to dwell with man. The ark was that central point. There's no doubt about that. And we're trying to marry up the two trains of thought here, that whereas Yahweh didn't look for mechanical worship, He looked for men and women to worship in upon an understanding that when they brought their offerings, they were doing so with a purpose in mind. And still with that distance involved, Yahweh kept man at arm's length. There were conditions to be met. But the children of Israel here had forgotten all the principles that God that God had in setting forth the tabernacle, and they saw it as almost a superstitious construction. They saw the ark as something that had power in itself. So the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring from thence the ark of the covenant of Yahweh Tzevaoth, which dwelleth between the cherubim. As if the ark has had some magical power within it. And they missed the point. In fact, in verse 6, when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout and said, "What meaneth the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews?" And they understood that the ark of Yahweh was come into the camp. And the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "Elohim is come into the camp." Woe unto us. They seem to have had a better understanding of what that ark symbolized than the children of Israel themselves. And so we've gone through the entire period of the Judges where men and women had forgotten, the people of God had forgotten that God wanted to dwell with them upon certain prescribed principles of truth. Until one man comes on the scene with a strong desire to instill those principles of truth, those principles of salvation, along with all their conditions, into the nation. And that man had such a burning desire in his heart. His mentor, the one who we feel perhaps had really fired him up, it was Samuel. The man I'm talking about, as you have already registered in your minds, was David. Samuel had indeed prepared the way. It's almost like the unwritten life of Samuel, isn't it? He transformed the period of the Judges in his circuit. Not a lot is written about that. But he transformed that nation. He turned it from the disconnected parts where judges ruled here and there throughout that period of the Judges, to a time when a faithful man could take hold of the nation. And sadly, the process started off with Saul, who had such an opportunity and looked so promising, but who sadly failed and didn't see those principles of salvation. Brother Steve quoted, "To obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of lambs." Saul had failed to understand that. But his successor David, it was left to him to establish the truth in the nation. David recognized the glorious principles of truth, and he sought to establish and enshrine it. And I'd like to follow up the process which led up to this particular point in time. 1 Samuel 19 verse 18. Well, again, the context. Saul is still alive, and he begins just about this point his fierce persecution and destruction of David. Verse 18, David has to flee for his life and escaped and came to Samuel to Ramah, and told him all that Saul had done unto him. And he and Samuel went and dwelt in Naoth. Very simply stated, but from other parts of the scripture, brief indications indicate that Samuel had accumulated around himself a group of individuals who were characterized by faithfulness and the love of the truth. This was the great work of Samuel. Those whose hearts and minds were right would have gravitated to him. It was once described that as the school of the prophets, that those had assembled there at Naoth with Samuel, and that's the very place where David went. The truth was not something in the household of Saul that David could hold on to, and he went and had time with Samuel. When he was in a desperate situation, the very place that he went to was characterized by the truth. And it was where Samuel was there and the prophets, and where the principles of God's truth would be strongly inculcated. Now, if you keep your finger in Samuel, because we're going to come back there, I'd like to turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 9. Because we have a glorious insight into the temple by looking at this verse. And I can remember being struck with this verse some years ago. Although we'd done our daily readings, I'd never really contemplated. I must have missed it in some frame or other. We read in 1 Chronicles 9, verse 22, verse 21 for connection, Zechariah the son of Meshelemiah was porter of the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. All these which were chosen to be porters in the gates were 212. These were reckoned by their genealogy in their villages, whom David and Samuel the seer did ordain in their set office. Samuel is mentioned here. Sometime after his death, we have an indication that Samuel was helping David to prepare his future position of leader over Israel. The very appointments of the temple had been ordained by Samuel and David. And David was a very young man, of course, when he fled to Naoth. Yet Samuel and David had been discussing the purpose of God to set up a place where his name would dwell. And David's mind from a young age then had been prepared to make this glorious sanctuary, if you like. And maybe when David had fled to Naoth, a place which means to rest, when David was there with Samuel discussed the need to unify the nation with Yahweh in their midst. Just like the people of Israel, as they journeyed through the wilderness with the tabernacle as the centerpiece of their journeys, as it were, so Samuel and David would have discussed the need for the centerpiece of this permanent position which Israel now had in the land. So there was a need to have a specific place to teach the principles of God's desire to dwell with man. Not just as an abstract place, but a place which would teach lessons for every Israelite to put into practice in their own life. And Brother Robert quoted last night, and so did Brother Steve in his address a little earlier on, the quote from Brother Roberts, which I thought was a really interesting quote. I don't remember it, but he said that every saint is a miniature tabernacle and temple. That's what God was desiring to show. That's what he was desiring to show from the cherubim in Eden, through the tabernacle in the wilderness, through the temple that was to be established. Not just an abstract place where, like the nations of the world, Chemosh, Baal, and all, they had shrines and places where people could just pour their offerings and the blood. That wasn't what God was desiring. That was the conditions upon which Yahweh could be approached. But the fact that the people would see the principles, like looking at the high priest, he had the names written upon the breastplate, the names of the children of Israel, just for the fact that they're 12 tribes. It taught Israel that when the high priest bore their names, he was only symbolizing what they should be in their daily lives. When he had his garments on for glory and for beauty, it was a symbol of what they should have been. And David was now looking at these principles to establish them for the nation at the time of this, inverted commas, permanent dwelling in the land. 2 Samuel chapter 5, from the verse we picked up in 1 Samuel 19, that was the time when David started off on a a period of turmoil for him. He had to flee from Saul until the time when he ultimately became king. And even then there was the civil war that he had between Israel and Judah, as it were. And then he had to subdue the enemies. There was, until we read in 2 Samuel 5 verse 12, David perceived that Yahweh had established him king over Israel and that he'd exalted his kingdom for his people Israel's sake. It was now the time to concentrate on spiritual issues. He himself had freedom from persecution. His enemies had been subdued, and he realized that here was the time Yahweh established the kingdom in his hands. And now David was not going to sit back and think, I can enjoy the fruits of my victory. In chapter 6 we read, again David gathered together all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000, and David arose and went with all the people that were with him from Baali of Judah to bring up from thence the Ark of Elohim, whose name is called by the name of Yahweh Tzevaoth, that dwelleth between the cherubims. Chronicles adds, for we inquired not at it in the days of Saul. We didn't inquire of the Ark in the days of Saul. But David, now that everything else had been put in order, recognized the spiritual values that needed to be rooted into the hearts and minds of the people of Israel. And so the very first thing that he does now, when peace is established, as it were, was to bring up the ark that dwelleth between the cherubims. The word dwelleth there is not the word shakan, it's the word yashab. I don't know if that's pronounced correctly. But Strong says it means to sit down, by implication, to dwell or to remain. So it has a very similar sort of idea established. And David wants to bring the one who dwells between the cherubim, the very symbol of the deity's presence, he wants to bring that into the very midst of Israel. Alas, the conditions which Yahweh always laid down were indeed overlooked somewhat by David, and we know the hiatus that occurred with the death of Uzzah when he touched the ark. And it says in verse 9, David was afraid of Yahweh that day and said, how shall the ark of Yahweh come to me? It wasn't a matter in David's mind of saying, well, forget that project. How can the ark of Yahweh come to me? Keep your finger in Samuel. Again, turn to the record as recorded in 1 Chronicles 15. And there we read in verse 1, David made him houses in the city of David and prepared a place for the Ark of Elohim and pitched it for a tent. How can the Ark? David had done some research. He recognized his shortcomings here. In his desire to bring up the Ark, he'd overlooked the fact that it needed to be borne by the priest, hadn't he? He'd overlooked that in his desire. And Yahweh's principles, even then, are shown to be unchanging, aren't they? Yahweh had said, it's got to be done this way. And even though David had shown from the very depths of his heart that his motives were pure and right, when things are not done right, even for a man like David, things won't turn out right unless they are done in accordance with what Yahweh says. And it says, then David said, none ought to carry the ark of Elohim but the Levites, for them hath Yahweh chosen to carry the ark of Elohim and to minister unto him forever. And David gathered all Israel together to Jerusalem to bring up the ark of Yahweh unto his place, which he had prepared for it, and David assembled the children of Aaron and the Levites. So David established the conditions whereby the ark could be brought up. And then there was that great rejoicing when he set it in the place in the midst of the tabernacle that David had pitched on it. Coming back to 2 Samuel 7, again that same word we read, the king said in verse 2 unto Nathan the prophet, see now, I dwell in an house of cedar, but the ark of Elohim dwelleth within curtains. David felt so conscious about his own position that he couldn't sit relaxed when, even though he'd brought the ark up, he'd established that ark in Jerusalem as it was at that time, and yet he felt that there was an incongruity where the ark had simple dwellings among curtains, and he was probably dwelling in some form of house which was much, much more elaborate, and it didn't sit comfortably in David's mind. Again, that word dwelleth is the word yashab. But David's heart, as we see it developing throughout his life, was centered on divine things. He was not content to allow the ark to just dwell in curtains. His desire was to create that tabernacle, that temple, which we feel certain he had been discussing with Samuel, so that the ark could, in David's mind, have a suitable dwelling place in the midst of the children of Israel. However, it was reserved for Solomon to do that. The question would be, where? Could you come with me now to 1 Chronicles chapter 21? We know the circumstances of this chapter. It's where David numbered Israel, and we think that Yahweh used that occasion to bring judgments upon the people of Israel, possibly because of their infidelity over the matter of Absalom. And Yahweh used this opportunity to bring judgments upon the people of Israel. And we know we read in verse 28 of 1 Chronicles 21. At that time, when David saw that Yahweh had answered him in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, that he sacrificed there for the tabernacle of Yahweh which Moses made in the wilderness, and the altar of the burnt offering were at that season in the high place at Gibeon. But David could not go before it to inquire of Elohim, for he was afraid because of the sword of the angel of Yahweh. It is a terrifying time here, when the angel of Yahweh was destroying the people of Israel. And then this one of the 22nd chapter leads right on to say, then David said, this is the house of Yahweh Elohim, and this is the altar of the burnt offering for Israel. As we suggested, David had probably been had in his mind since he was a young man the desire to build a temple. And we know that various references throughout the Kings and Chronicles shows David's intense desire to build this temple. He had been discussing it with Samuel. The question would be, where would it be built? And it dawns upon David here, this is the house of Yahweh Elohim. He suddenly realizes in what was taking place here in the 21st chapter that this was where God intended for David to build or start to prepare for that temple to be built. The full realization of what God had shown him now dawned on David. Interesting points to note in chapter 21, which we probably won't look at this time, with the angel flying in mid-heaven, or in mid-heaven. But we think that here the realization had now dawned on David. What more appropriate than Moriah? And we understand this particular area was Moriah, where Abraham had offered Isaac. What more appropriate, where the principles of salvation, as indicated in the offering of Isaac by Abraham, as pointing forward to the great Redeemer, what more appropriate place could there be for the temple to be established? And we read in verse 2 of this 22nd chapter, David commanded to gather together the strangers that were in the land of Israel. And he set masons to hew wrought stones to build the house of Elohim. David prepared iron in abundance for the nails, for the doors of the gates, and for the joinings, and brass in abundance without weight, cedar trees in abundance for the Zidonians. And they of Tyre brought much cedar wood to David. And David said, Solomon, my son, is young and tender, and the house that is to be builded for Yahweh must be exceeding magnificent, of fame and of glory throughout all countries. I will therefore now make preparation for it. So David prepared abundantly before his death. We get an insight there, of course, into the insight of David. that even though he himself had been told by Yahweh in our introductory reading that he would not be the one to build that house, he didn't take an attitude whereby he left it all to Solomon then and sulkily sort of left the task to someone else. He engaged in it, and there are some big lessons for us even in that. He engaged with it, and again his heart and mind was fully engaged in the work of the truth. He called for Solomon his son in verse 6, charged him to build a house for Yahweh Elohim of Israel. And David said to Solomon, "My son, as for me, it was in my mind to build an house unto the name of Yahweh my Elohim, unto the name of Yahweh my Elohim. But the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Thou hast shed blood abundantly, and hast made great wars. Thou shalt not build an house unto my name, because thou hast shed much blood upon the earth in my sight." It appears that David's warfare made it incongruous for him to be associated with that great house, and so he was unable to build it. But he still prepares, and we read in verse 17, David also commanded all the princes of Israel to help Solomon his son, saying, "Is not Yahweh your Elohim with you? And hath he not given you rest on every side? For he hath given the inhabitants of the land into mine hand, for the land is subdued before Yahweh and before his people. Now set your heart and your soul to seek Yahweh your Elohim. Arise therefore and build thee the sanctuary of Yahweh Elohim, to bring the ark of the covenant of Yahweh and the holy vessels of Elohim into the house that is to be built to the name of Yahweh." And so even though David himself could not build that house, he could prepare for it. And he could prepare the hearts and minds of the people who would be responsible with Solomon for doing this great work. Set your heart and soul to seek Yahweh. And isn't that the principle that in Eden was being taught by God, that was being taught in the tabernacle, that the people of Israel were being led to seek Yahweh? That's the only way that Yahweh could dwell with man. Yes, his physical glory could appear before the cherubim, but these things taught a greater lesson than that. Yahweh must dwell in our hearts and in our minds. Yes, the plan was David's. 1 Chronicles chapter 28, verse 2. David the king stood up upon his feet. And apparently this was at a time when it suggested that David was ill. But even though he was ill, and possibly too ill really to stand up with comfort, he stands upon his feet and says, "Hear me, my brethren and my people. As for me, I had in mine heart to build an house of rest for the ark of the covenant of Yahweh, and for the footstool of our Elohim, and hath made ready for the building. But Elohim said unto me, Thou shalt not build an house for my name, because thou hast been a man of war, and hast shed blood." Perhaps there, in the desire for Yahweh to dwell with man, such a man as David, with such warfare in his background, would not have been a fitting type to demonstrate that principle of Yahweh desiring to dwell with man when he himself had shed much blood. But that word rest that is contained there verse 2, I had in my heart to build a house of rest. The word there means to repose peacefully. Figuratively, it can mean consolation. It was the rest which Naomi sought for Ruth. She desired to obtain rest for Ruth. And this was how David saw it, that the ark had been transported from place to place to place. Now there was an opportunity for it to rest in a permanent structure. And as we know, the tabernacle spoke of a temporary dwelling place, and speaks even now of our probationary life, doesn't it, as we wait for the return of the Master. We have no firm, permanent abode. We are, as it were, sojourning in this land. And so David sees the temple now as an opportunity, when it's constructed, to have the ark rest in there in a time of peace and tranquility, a time when God would be the centre of the kingdom of Israel, which would illuminate the rest of the nations. Here, the very principles which could be seen in the tabernacle would now be exemplified for not just Israel, but the nations to behold. It was a permanent dwelling place. Verse 11 of this 28th chapter of Chronicles, David gave to Solomon his son the pattern of the porch and of the houses thereof and of the treasuries thereof and of the upper chambers thereof and of the inner parlours thereof and of the place of the mercy seat, and the pattern of all that he had by the Spirit of the courts of the house of Yahweh and of all the chambers round about, of the treasuries of the house of Elohim and of all the treasuries of the dedicated things, also for the course of the priests and the Levites and for all the work of the service of the house of Yahweh and for all the vessels of the service in the house of Yahweh. You know, we tend to think of Solomon's temple as Solomon getting the design and put it. It was David through the Spirit had this design, the pattern of all that he had by the Spirit. David did a phenomenal work in the preparation for that temple, and David gave to Solomon the pattern of the house itself. David had given all this to Solomon. And we read in verse 1 of 1 Chronicles 29, "Furthermore, David the king said unto all the congregation, Solomon my son, whom alone Elohim hath chosen, is yet young and tender, and the work is great. For the palace is not for man, but for Yahweh Elohim." This wasn't something that was going to be for man, it was to be for Yahweh, so that Yahweh could be exemplified, Yahweh could be glorified. And so we read in, if we turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 3, we read, "Solomon began to build the house of Yahweh at Jerusalem in Mount Moriah, where Yahweh appeared unto David his father, in the place that David had prepared in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite." Solomon now begins this great work of constructing the temple, and the various chapters that follow indicate the great work which Solomon engaged in, which David had given. You probably will be relieved I'm not going to give a detail now with the time that's run out. Brother Matthew will be, God willing, commencing a detailed study on it. But we feel that what David had done, when we come to this point in time, his heart, every fibre of his being, was endeavouring to put Yahweh at the heart of the nation and in the hearts of men and women. That's the only way that Yahweh could dwell with man. I've almost got a almost presenting for consideration a dichotomy of the subject, in as much as Yahweh was dwelling in the tabernacle. Yahweh dwelt in the tabernacle, but in what Yahweh was trying to teach was he himself wanted to dwell in the hearts and minds of men and women. David saw that perfectly. It was his great consideration. He discussed it, we feel, for so many hours with Samuel. And he himself was such an exemplification of those principles. And now Solomon, on a large and a grand scale, entered into the glorious details of the house, which far exceeded the details of the tabernacle, with all the beauty of the tabernacle that was there. The house that Solomon now constructed exceeded in grandeur. And in symbol, the most holy place itself was a perfect cube, 20 cubits, 8,000 cubic cubits. the symbol of the cutting off of the flesh and the glorious principles of immortality once again enshrouded in a greater symbolic structure with this permanent temple now fixed in the middle of Israel. And turn back with me to 1 Kings chapter 6 to see this position which Solomon now was establishing. 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 11 we read, "The word of Yahweh came to Solomon, saying, concerning this house which thou art in building, if thou wilt walk in my statutes and execute my judgments and keep all my commandments to walk in them, then will I perform my word with thee, which I spake unto David thy father." And you know, it is the principles of salvation, isn't it? Concerning this house which thou art in building. And you would almost, you know, think to read, make sure you do it in accordance with this pattern. But we read, if thou wilt walk in my statutes. The house would have been useless if Solomon and the people of Israel were not going to walk in God's statutes. That's the real desire of God dwelling with man. He's not dwelling in bricks and mortar and timber. He wants to dwell in us. If thou wilt walk in my statutes, execute my judgments and keep all my commandments to walk in them, then will I perform my word with thee. And verse 13 says, and I will dwell among the children of Israel. And interestingly enough, that word dwell is the word the shakan, to reside permanently. The Shekinah glory. But Yahweh doesn't say, and I will dwell between the cherubim. I will dwell among the children of Israel. Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. Not that I may dwell in it. Not make this temple of Solomon that I will dwell in that cherubim. Yes, of course that's where Yahweh couldn't do it any other way. Yes, the glory would consume us. But that I may dwell among the children of Israel. The only way that Yahweh could do that in symbol was to this glorious construction that was now about to be made, and which Solomon did make. And Yahweh would dwell in that. Yes, the glory would fill it. But the real symbol which the children of Israel needed to see and observe was that it was Yahweh in them. As Brother Steve quoted from the words of a Brother Thomas, God manifestation, not human salvation, is the great purpose of the Eternal Spirit. 1 Kings 8, verse 21. 1 Kings 8, verse 21, we read, "I have set there a place for the ark," says Solomon, "wherein is the covenant of Yahweh, which he made with our fathers when he brought them out of the land of Egypt." So the temple has been constructed, and Solomon says, "I have set a place for the ark." It might be interesting to look up that word "place" if anyone's got a concordance on them. It might be indicated the same word "shakan." I meant to look up earlier on in the address Deuteronomy 16 verse 2, where it says that in the purpose of God, he was going to obtain a place where he would place a temple. I'm not quoting that very well, but the word "placed" is actually the word "shakan," meaning to dwell. And here Solomon is now saying, "I've set there the place of the ark." And we read in verse 23, he said, "Yahweh Elohim of Israel, there is no Elohim like thee in heaven above or on earth beneath, who keepeth covenant and mercy with thy servants, that walk before thee with all their heart." That walk before thee with all their heart. And you know, Solomon recognizes a glorious truth. He says in verse 26, "And now, O Elohim of Israel, let thy word, I pray thee, be verified, which thou spakest unto thy servant David my father. But will Elohim indeed dwell on the earth?" It's a the word Yashab there. Behold, the heaven and heaven of heavens cannot contain thee, how much less this house that I have builded. And I think that Solomon recognized the wonder of it all. The fact that Yahweh said, yes, he did desire to dwell with man, but in reality, the glorious and all-powerful deity, Solomon says, how on earth could this marvelous house which I have now constructed, how on earth could that house thee? The heaven of heavens cannot contain me, much less this house that I have built. Yet, he says in verse 28, have thou respect unto the prayer of thy servant, and to his supplication, O Yahweh my Elohim, to hearken unto the cry and to the prayer which thy servant prayeth before thee today, that thine eyes may be open toward this house night and day, even toward the place of which thou hast said, my name shall be there, that thou mayest hearken unto the prayer which thy servant shall make toward this place. Solomon recognizes that the heaven of heavens cannot contain the deity, and yet he had established this house whereby the children of Israel could come, look towards, and gain the comfort and consolation that Yahweh was establishing. And in that wonderful prayer that Solomon gave, he was really showing that this tabernacle indicated God's desire to dwell with man, because he prays that if this would happen, then if the children of Israel came back, that Yahweh would forgive. Could we go back to 2 Chronicles 7? This is going to be our final quotation. We really must wind up then. 2 Chronicles chapter 7. We read in verse 1, when Solomon had made an end of praying, the fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of Yahweh filled the house. And the priests could not enter into the house of Yahweh because the glory of Yahweh had filled the house. Here was the glory of Yahweh dwelling between the cherubim. Verse 16 we read, now I have chosen and sanctified this house that my name may be there forever, and mine eyes and mine heart shall be there perpetually. And as for thee, if thou wilt walk before me as David thy father walked, and do according to all that I have commanded thee, and shalt observe my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of my kingdom according as I have covenanted with David thy father, saying, there shall not fail thee a man to be ruler in Israel. And so this wonderful house was finished. The glory came down and inhabited. The lessons taught the need for people to walk in God's ways. And if that would happen, and if thou wilt walk before me, then the kingdom would be established. This was, after all, a permanent structure, and a glorious structure at that. True it was that Solomon said, Yahweh dwelleth not in temples made with hands. The temple that we have considered just very briefly was destroyed. And the glory, as recorded in Ezekiel, departed. And even Solomon himself, turned away and apostatized from the truth. Even this glorious temple that Solomon had constructed, even the labor that David himself had expended towards it, could not save the temple from destruction when it became an empty symbol. It could only point the way forward in time to the greater manifestation of the deity in his son and in the people who would still follow those principles of salvation which were established from the beginning. It could only now point in type to the time when the great edifice, that house of prayer for all nations, would be established, which would be characterized not by erring mortality, but by unerring immortality, by the glory of the deity manifested in spirit in a host of those who were redeemed upon the principles of salvation, upon the principles of the desire of the deity to dwell with man, upon his principles in accordance with his ways. As Brother Steve concluded his remarks, let us consider the lessons that are associated with this glorious theme of the desire of the deity to dwell with man. Let us consider the lessons and ensure that we inculcate them in our hearts and minds, so that we become dwelling places of the deity each day of our lives.